Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast that cost me $5. I seriously thought Andrew was going to follow Wes Studi to Planes, Fire, and Rescue from 2014. But no, instead we're talking about a much, much better film. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanegeiser. I will have you know, David, I'll give you $250 back because that movie was on the short list.
Well, like I said, there's something about these Disney DTV spin-offs from the Cars universe that I think really does require a highly critical eye to be brought to it.
Well, I mean, it solves all the lingering questions that were left behind at the end of Cars and Cars 2.
This is true. It also helps that these, apparently the Planes films have a much better cast than the actual main films. I mean, Ed Harris is in this thing, apparently.
Really?
Hal Holbrook. Yeah.
Hal Holbrook? He's still alive?
Well, this is from 2014, so let's take a look. Is Hal Holbrook still alive? Yes, he is.
Oh, wow. The man that time forgot.
Indeed. So, kudos, I guess.
Yeah. Hal Holbrook, congratulations, and here's to 100 more.
Yeah. But we digress right off the bat. What are we actually doing today, Andrew?
Well, those of you joining us from last week will know that we took a detour through the mysterious jungle region of Shadowloo, and we have come to find ourselves right smack dab in downtown Los Angeles. This week, we are looking at Michael Mann's 1995 heist film, Heat. Brought to you courtesy of a side road provided by Wes Studi, who appears in both.
Yes.
So, there were, coming off of Street Fighter, which, for the record, is a whole lot of fun, and you should go watch it if you haven't yet. There were a lot of different avenues to go, but I picked this one kind of to satisfy my own curiosity, and to also give Dave something nice. Because as long as you and I have known each other, I have known that, well, two things. You have forgotten more about film than I will ever learn, and that nobody, and I mean nobody save for Mrs. Mann, probably loves Michael Mann as much as you do. And that's something that I have never quite been able to put my finger on.
Interesting. So, yeah, but no, this is true. I am a hardcore Michael Mann fan. I am something I think I could easily call myself a man apologist in many regards. Those who listen to the old Cinema Chase program that me and James were on, we took a look at Michael Mann, at my all-time favorite film for our very first episode on that program, which was the Michael Mann film Manhunter.
That's still your all-time favorite, eh?
It is my all-time favorite film, and I will probably be until the day I die. I absolutely love that film. And we also discussed Michael Mann back on 24 Panels Per Second briefly when we talked about the comic book adaptation of the novel The Keep, which we used as an excuse to talk about Michael Mann's failed 1983 adaptation of that novel, which... fascinating failure. But it is indeed a failure, but fascinating. So if you can still somehow have those saved somewhere in your back catalog somewhere, by all means, give those a listen. But yeah, I really dig Michael Mann. I'm always eager and looking forward to whatever he's got up his sleeve. But from what I'm getting here, Andrew, that's not necessarily the case with you.
Well, okay, I think it's also one of those areas where I only realized very, very recently that you and I were a couple years apart in age. And I just generally assume people I meet in my schooling and that they're all the exact same age with the exact same life circumstances. And, you know, thinking about that, I'm like, well, because I was born in 86, so by the time I was TV age, I was a 90s kid. Like, I didn't live in a place where, you know, I could catch Miami Vice reruns or anything like that. So for a while, I thought it was an adolescence thing. You know, it's not that I dislike Michael Mann. I'm not hugely well-versed in his oeuvre. I've seen Collateral, I've seen The Insider, back when I was probably too young to understand what's really going on in it.
Yeah.
He's always been there, and I mean, he's still making movies, and there's a certain section of film enthusiasts that he is always going to have quite a bit of stock with. And, you know, that's fine. I certainly see why people respond to his work, and why they like his films in terms of, you know, his career longevity as being a commercially and critically successful American filmmaker. He's got a good track record. But there's that other camp that insists, like, he's a modern auteur, and they would describe some of his films as masterpieces. And I've never been able to make that leap myself as a viewer.
Okay. So, interesting. Well, I think it helps partly for me is that, I mean, I will say this. My experience with Michael Mann, really begins with Manhunter itself. Like I said, that's a film I discovered back in my first or second year of high school. And that was my launching point. And that's a film that it hit me right at the proper formative point, where auteurism as a thing that I understood cognitively as an intellectual, concept. You know, I always understood watching Michael Mann's work, though, is the thing that sort of solidified and allowed me to understand the idea of, no, this is a distinctive voice that is being brought to works of cinema. That is, you know, an intellect that is guiding what we're seeing.
Yeah, and if I may cut in, and for the home listeners that didn't go to Laurier's film program, in base terms, David, what do we mean when we talk about auteurs as opposed to directors?
The idea of the auteur is that they are the central authoritative figure when it comes to understanding, as being the author of a film and sort of part and parcel of trying to decipher its meaning as such.
Yeah, because basically, film as an industrial process requires a whole lot of moving parts, a whole lot of different people making a film happen. And we often think about the director as the creator, but auteur theory sort of emerges to be like, well, not every film is a singular author's vision, but some of them are. And auteur theory kind of emerges to explain that. Well, you have your classics like Alfred Hitchcock, Ingmar Bergman. You know, these are people with a strong degree of control over their productions, usually a consistent set of stylistic and thematic concerns that come through in various works of theirs. Basically, the idea that when you're watching a Michael Mann film, you know you're watching a Michael Mann film. And in that respect, yes, I would say he does succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the mistake that ends up happening with auteur theory and the idea of the auteur is that somehow gets held up as a barometer of quality. And that's not really what it serves as. I mean, I think by all accounts, unquestionably, Michael Bay is an auteur.
That's the go-to example.
And then same thing with Ed Wood. I honestly, you can watch an Ed Wood movie and you will recognize an Ed Wood movie distinctively, but it's a bad, but I mean, let's not kid ourselves. His films aren't good. And unfortunately, I think part of it is the fact that the auteur theory became this barometer, I think, particularly for its original sort of founding, the initial French New Wave critics, which used it as a way to sort of bestow grandeur and prestige on filmmakers who worked within the Hollywood studio system, who somehow, in their view, basically managed to get their vision on screen despite the system.
Yeah, the idea that... Yeah, at the outset of the Nouvelle Vague, and, you know, you have guys like Godard making films, and suddenly they're writing in, you know, journals like Cahiers du Cinéma and saying, well, hey, we've gone back, and even though nobody would say His Girl Friday is a masterpiece of cinema, Howard Hawks, however, well, he's consistent through his films. He's that kind of director you want to pay attention to. So it very easily can be confused with arguments about quality, and sort of that false assumption that uniqueness necessarily makes something a better film. So, I mean, for our purposes here, though, we're just using auteur to mean that this is a director with a very distinct style that remains constant across different films. Can we agree
and
to
the
that?
Thing with Mike, yeah, I think we can definitely absolutely agree to that. I mean, honestly, again, if you watch Michael Mann's work, it is unmistakable whenever he makes a film, because in terms of his shot selection, in terms of the editing processes, the cinematography is just gorgeous. It certainly his style has evolved over time, particularly as he's moved into the digital age. He's one of the filmmakers who certainly was an early adopter of digital video technology, and is starting with, I believe, Collateral was the first film.
Yeah, I remember when that came out, there was a big to-do over him using DV for it, and it allows him to have a very unique look to his films. It's one that I feel is imitated a lot, and in that respect, well, it's successful if it becomes the standard. But Collateral, especially at the time, it did look visually distinct from a lot of other sort of high-profile Hollywood offerings.
And I think this is one of the things about Michael Mann that's very hard, because, as you're right, he is a highly respected filmmaker in some regards, but I think one of the things that's very tricky about Michael Mann is that, unlike auteurs such as Hitchcock or De Palma, that where, you know, people tend to, you know, overtly look back at them and, you know, sort of point their fingers as to that's the influence. Michael Mann has almost been a stealth influence in a way, because he, you know, in many ways came to define the sort of look of hard-edge crime fiction in the 1980s through series such as Miami Vice and Crime Story. And his style that he developed over the course of his films has been imitated a great deal by things that have come since, such as CSI, amongst other programs.
If it wasn't for Miami Vice, the barometer would have been Cop Rock.
Yes. But, I mean, that's the thing. When it comes down to, I think a lot of people, you know, overlook or just lump Man in with a particular thing, not realizing that, A, he sort of originates this, and B, I still think he does it infinitely better. Because I will say this, part of why Michael Mann's work registers for me is, in many ways, it's kind of the ideal sim. Like, I can get lost in his films in a way that I can't with other filmmakers. I mean, the look, the sounds, the design of these films, the worlds he populates, his themes, these are things that really, really appeal and hit a hard note for me. And that's not to say every film he's made has been an out-and-out slam dunk, as it were.
Well, he did make Public Enemies.
Which, underrated movie. Flawed, but underrated. And likewise, I think the same thing about Black Hat. Even The Keep, a film that I will admit, by most objective standards, is not a good movie. There's stuff you can plainly point to, it's not a good movie. But my God, on a visual and oral level, that thing is gorgeous to watch and listen to. It is just completely encompassing and absorbing. Which kind of brings us to, in a roundabout way, to Heat.
I'm really glad that we hit on the same segue at the same time.
Yeah, which is the thing, because Heat in many ways is, I think the safest way to describe it, it's Mann's magnum opus. This is his, the great work. And for many hardcore Michael Mann fans, this is the film they point to as the definitive Mann movie. Which, funny enough, I'm going to say that's not actually. There are at least two or three I would put above Heat, as much as I love this film. But
also in terms of whoever's going to be listening, this is probably going to be the tentpole Mann film that they might be familiar with as well. Certainly Heat. Yeah. I think certain sequences of it have been imitated, rarely ever duplicated. It's been cited as an overt influence in a lot of sort of more modern crime and heist films. And also it's that rare film where, almost like Menace to Society, where it ends up being used in the real world as a reference for illegal acts. Not a lot of other films can say that.
And military training, I might add.
Yes.
The way in which Val Kilmer reloads his automatic weapons during the infamous bank heist scene midway through the film, is actually used as saying, no, that's how you do it properly. And I think that actually, I mean, this, when we get into Man, I think in full, I think this will bring us into one of the reasons I find him so appealing, which is the notion that this is, Man is a meticulous filmmaker in a way not many people are. One of the things we haven't noted here is this is a man who has been working steadily since the at least the 80s as a director. He has not produced that many films in total, though. He's maybe makes like something about three a decade at most, thing, which is, you know, considered to prolific filmmakers such as Steven Spielberg or other filmmakers out there. I mean, that's a pittance. I mean, he's not Kubrick levels of bad, who would, you know, take like a whole decade to research his stuff before cranking it out. But, you know, Mann really does research and put a lot of effort into his films. And I think whenever you're watching his film, watching his films, the intellect, the choices he's making, it's very much there in a way that it's apparent, but it's not distracting in a way that I think some people say you could point to maybe Christopher Nolan as an example of where it's too, maybe too mannered, too calculated in some ways. You know, Mann has all the intellect, but it never feels like he's got that issue going on.
All right. Well, I think we're almost taping our hands there. If I could rein you back for a moment. So let's get into what is Heat about? And I think meticulous is another hinge word. Heat at heart is a cops and robbers story. Yet it's made vastly more complicated by its own narrative. In its most basic form, Robert De Niro plays Neil McCauley, who's a career criminal, the cool under pressure, like clockwork plan, professional heist man. He works with his small crew in Los Angeles. He sort of adopts his own samurai-esque code of never being so close to anything that you can't drop it and walk away in 30 seconds if you feel the heat around the corner. And he meets his match in Detective William Hanna, played by Al Pacino, who's the haunted and driven detective who plays by his own rules but will stop at nothing to bring him down. So at the same time, though, that gets filtered through the film's initial heist, leads to McCauley and his crew acquiring some bearer bonds, and then in the process of trying to sell it back to the man that they stole it from, everything gets a lot more complicated, more bodies end up, and these two men end up on what's an inevitable collision course. One way or another, they're going to collide, and only one of them is going to walk away from it.
Yeah, I'll put it this way. I mean, Heat is the film that, for Michael Mann for years, was sort of his great white shark. He had written this, if I remember the timeline correctly, even prior to doing Thief, his directorial debut, you know, back in 81. And, you know, it's a film that for a long time, by his own admission, he didn't necessarily feel he was up to making. Like, he wasn't, you know, ready. He found it very daunting. And at points offered it, for example, to Walter Hill at one time, who would have made a very different movie out of this. And I like to, as much as I love Hill, I think it was for the best that that didn't happen. Eventually, you know, he did a extremely condensed version of this as a made-for-TV film that was supposed to be a backdoor pilot for a show called L.A. Takedown, which in many ways is Heat condensed down to 90 minutes or less, which is saying something when you consider that this film is a nearly three-hour epic when we get down to it. And as you're sort of noting here, Andrew, the general gist of the film, in terms of its characters, themes, and what it's doing, sounds like a, you know, your stock cops and robbers film. It sounds like a very generic cops and robbers thriller. And to a degree, I'm not going to lie, there is an element of it that is. And if you're going into this thing thinking you're going to see a film that is a completely innovative, redefines how the crime genre works in terms of the story that's being told, Heat is probably a film you would come away disappointed to. However, and I think this is the big thing, what makes Heat so fascinating and why it works is, This is literally a crime epic. This is Mann taking many of the themes and ideas that he developed, starting back with Thief in 81, and redoing them and remixing them on a much larger scale. And that scale includes both in terms of narrative complexity, in terms of thematic complexity, in terms of attention to detail. And I think it's kind of interesting from what you're sort of suggesting here, Andrew, when you're describing some of the characters in that, which is in some ways on the base level sound like archetypes, certainly, like the haunted detective. But when you get into the film proper and into the nitty-gritty minutia of it,
it plays out very differently.
Yeah, it plays out very differently and is a much richer experience for this. Because this is, like I said, it's a nearly 3-hour film, and it's not a thriller in the sense that it's a ticking clock film where everything is, you know, rushing towards a headlong conclusion. This is a film that takes its time and wallows in the world that it exists in. And I think one of the things I really appreciate about it is not only does it take the time to do that, this is not a film that holds your hand trying to get you to, you know, cheap thrills as quickly as possible. This is a film that really expects you to keep up.
Well, yeah, for a film this is, like, considering its plot and considering its runtime, like, it does have a lot of downtime. Like, in the sense where if you try and think of this film as an action thriller, it doesn't really work because, like, there are some enormous set pieces here, but it's almost like every hour of the film has one. And as opposed to, like, something like A New Hope, where there's more of a serialistic, like, constant thrust forward. Here, like, there are a number of sequences where it almost seems, like, peripheral to the main plot. And yet, like, by the film's conclusion, like, all of these scenes end up mattering. I think in our discussions before we started recording, you described this film's plot structure as novelistic, and I think that's a very apt way of putting it. Because if you look at, I don't necessarily want to compare this to Dostoevsky, for instance, but there's the strict plot summary, but, I mean, even, like, you can describe Ulysses as a day in the life of people in Dublin, but that's not really what the book is about, and that's not what it really involves. So this film can easily be marketed and sold as the cops and robbers tale between, like, the two men who are different sides of the same coin, but that is also, like, woefully inadequate to describe what actually happens in this film.
Yeah, and I mean, I kept trying to think of an easy way to boil this movie down in a way that you could, would be like your easy go-to bullet point for, this is what Heat's about, and you can't really do it. I mean, the closest I could come is this is a film that's very much about, you know, as in most Michael Mann films, I mean, the Michael Mann protagonist in many ways is always the professional. It is somebody who knows their job, knows their trade, is laser-focused, and immaculate at it. And that is very much the case here, but it's very much writ large in terms of, we are in the self-destructive lives of these kind of professionals. And it's very much a case where we have people whose professional status and their sort of, again, their identity, who they are, is, you know, sort of at odds with some of their own desires in terms of whether it's, in particular, their domestic desires, as it were. Because, again, to sort of boil it down, the sort of linchpin that sort of connects these films, aside from the general plotline, is the fact that we more or less follow three distinct professionals and their relationships that they have outside of. We have, as we noted here, Neil McCulley, an individual who doesn't have, played by Robert De Niro, who doesn't have anything in his life. He is very much, as we said, a very stripped down, to the point where in one beautiful shot we see him in his apartment and we quickly realize there is nothing in the apartment really. He's got like a desk,
and I like how they don't make a big deal of it and they don't hit you over the head and be like, look everyone, it's a metaphor, but he's got this beautiful ocean view, like this luxury condo, and he has two chairs and a coffee maker.
Exactly. And yeah, the most they make of it is, you know, our other couple is Chris, the other one of the our trio of professionals here, who is McCulley's, one of his key members of his crew.
And played by Val Kilmer, pre-Batman.
Yes, Val. Yeah, immediately pre-Batman. This is released the same year as Forever. But yeah, I mean, this is Val Kilmer, you know, playing Chris. This, you know, again, technically proficient individual, good with explosives, knows his job, and he's also a gambling addict with a wife and child, whom he, I think it's safe to say that their relationship is at best
tumultuous,
rocky?
Yeah,
tumultuous, verbally abusive in some ways and violent, and you know, again, his his proclivities from gambling, his inability to sort of focus on the idea of, no, we're building a life here, causes tension within their marriage, which is carried out in the fact that she's having a quasi-affair with another individual played by Hank Azaria, of all people.
Yeah, it feels weird to see him pop up in any dramatic role. And I also realized we have a new segment I'd like to announce, Missed Connections, where I realize Hank Azaria and Wes Studi were both in the film Mystery Men as well.
Yes. both very excellent in that movie, to boot. But yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so yeah, there's so the Chris plot. And so, again, there's the, we have the professional that lives the monastic life. We have a professional on the wrong side of the law who has a terrible home life. And then on the right side of the law, we have William Hanna, Al Pacino, who, again, crack operative and has absolutely no idea how to do anything other than be a detective.
Well, and this is the thing. And I found it curious when you phrased him, you referred to him as the haunted detective, which I think as a surface reading, a quick glance is an easy way to describe him, but I think kind of misunderstands the character, because he is, I don't think Hannah's haunted at all in this film. This is a guy who loves his job to the point, to the detriment of everything else. And he's not haunted by it.
What about his dream about dead balloon people? You don't have that if you're well adjusted.
But this is the thing. I mean, he makes these speeches, and I think this is the interesting thing about Hannah, is that he is a performative character. He is a guy who's constantly going around presenting things, you know, a perception of himself to people around him. Whether it's the criminals he meets on the street, where he's being absolutely over the top and crazy and shouting lines about, you know, people's posteriors that I will not quote out verbatim on this podcast. And then you have, you know, things, but I think it's the exact same thing with his wife. I mean, he ostensibly gives a version of the Captain Kirk, I need my pain speech from the Final Frontier, at a point where he basically flat out admits, it's like, you know, I could share all this stuff with you, but I need it because it helps me to do my job. And the thing about the way he's presented is he loves his job. He's not really disturbed in the same sense that, you know, it's not like, for example, to go to another Michael Mann film, you know, Will Graham in Manhunter, a character who, you know, is both, you know, is repulsed and yet attracted to these very dark things. I don't think Hannah's ever repulsed. I mean, think about, you know, probably one of my favorite shots in this movie, late in the film. And yeah, we're into spoiler territory here, folks. One of the big running plot lines of his domestic side of his life is his stepdaughter, played by a very young Natalie Portman here. And she is somebody who her stepfather keeps missing her. Her mother, who is basically a stoned, you know, addict, as it were, and is
doesn't make her a bad person, Dave.
Doesn't make her a bad person, but the point of the matter is she seems to be oblivious to what's going on in her daughter's life. The only person who recognizes there's something wrong with her is Hannah, and he does nothing about it. And eventually she commits or tries to commit suicide. And there's this big thing that in our notes you refer to as the reconciliation scene, except nothing about that strikes me as a reconciliation.
I think it's Hannah the closest up, that he, we get. It's difficult. I think it's hard to talk about acontextually, but okay. I think maybe you're misunderstanding where I'm coming from, Dave. I think we can split the difference where it's not, I say haunted in the sense that he is a man who, his job, and like, you're right, he does love bringing down like the worst of the worst, we're told at various times, and he seems to welcome that, but that doesn't necessarily mean he loves what he does. And I think by the time you get to the diner scene, this film makes it clear that regardless of what Macaulay and Hannah are doing, they feel that what they are doing is what they are meant to do, and there's that sense of duty. And it's a sense of duty that leads them to fail in their duties to others around them. It's that idea of, you know, we're the best at what we do, and so this is what we have to do. And that doesn't mean that they necessarily like it. I mean, Macaulay himself is given an emotional arc where he recognizes there needs to be more to his life than just pulling off heists and disappearing. And so it's that uneasy negotiation of realizing, maybe I don't want to do what I'm meant to do anymore, but what else can I do? And this is, I think, true. I call it the moment of reconciliation, because that's the moment where I think Hannah, not necessarily he's like, because it's not like he ignores his beeper after that or says, no, the job doesn't matter anymore. But I think he recognizes that his sense of duty can be transferred to something else. And even when he's talking to his presumably soon-to-be ex-wife, he's saying, like, I don't know where this puts us, but I can be here for you. It's the sense of, like, it, maybe everything's not made okay, and maybe he hasn't learned a big lesson, but he realizes he can do something more than just the everything he's done up until that point.
Up until his wife then tells him to go, and you see him like skipping down the stairs almost joyously as he gets to go after Macaulay one last time out the door. And I love that shot of him just like, because it's not just that he's rushing down the stairs. There's like a jump of joy to what's going on in his thing, as much as he tries to play it subdued. You know, there is these little implications that, you know, Hannah's got. You know, but ultimately, yeah, I mean, he leaves the hospital. He abandons his, you know, whether ex-wife or continuing.
He's not abandoning. He finally has her blessing to go and do what he must.
Yeah.
And I think part of that joy is the fact that he no longer has to feel like his life is bifurcated. Because even in the confrontation they have after the party, where he has to leave and go survey a crime scene, he comes back. And she presses him, like, why do you not talk about what you see on the job? And he gives that speech, the Captain Kirk, where he effectively says, like, these are different facets of my life, and you cannot be a part of this. And whereas, I think, going into the climax of the film, he recognizes, okay, maybe there is an option in between all or nothing.
I think it's a very optimistic reading of that conclusion, because ultimately with the way everything leaves, like, I mean, it's very notable that the one scene we don't get is the ultimate fate of Natalie Portman's character. We never see her come back.
That's true.
The one character that Hannah, we know Hannah at least pays some attention to her and recognizes things aren't all right. And like I said, I'm kind of convinced that when this film's all said and done, she's going to attempt this again. Like, that's a bleak reading of this movie. I fully admit it, but I mean, it kind of fits with the rest of this film, which is ultimately nobody in this movie gets an out. Nobody gets a good ending or a happy ending. The best we get.
Debatable.
I honestly don't think we do. I mean, the best you get, I mean, the only character I can think of who really gets a good ending is Nate, played by John Voight. And that's mainly because his entire role in this film is, yeah, I broker deals and occasionally give you, you know, the news you want to hear, but that's about it. Maybe Tom Noonan. I guess he didn't get his money, though. But
he got some pretty prominent billing, considering that, yeah, Tom Noonan, he's only in the one scene, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a good scene, but... And, yeah, because he's also a mainstay in Man, is he not? I know he's Manhunt. He's Dollar Hyde in Manhunter, right?
Yeah, that's the only other film that he is specifically... I mean, that's the thing. Like, there are people who recur in Michael Mann's works, but they only tend to recur twice, I think, so far. For the most part. Like, you get people such as... I mean, except for Dennis Farina, who I think maybe he breaks it. Or does he? Oh, I guess if you count Crime Story, he does. But anyways, yeah, we're way all over the map on this one here. But I think that's kind of indicative of the issue, or what the thing with this film is, that it's not easy to break apart into its separate components.
It's almost like a Fibonacci sequence, in the sense where it begins and we have the main plot point, which is Macaulay versus Hannah, you know, the brawl to settle it all. But then from all the events that happen, it branches off into different storylines, which they themselves, as they develop, branch outwards. And it's only going into the climax that some of the loose threads, like, for instance, Hank Azaria, it seems like an aside, but his character ends up being completely instrumental to the plot. Wayne Grow, the loose cannon on the crew, who ends up killing hostages in the opening sequence, he disappears for about two-thirds of the film, but he reappears, and when he does, it makes total sense for the film's endgame. Chris and his wife and their issues, you know, it seems peripheral, but it ends up making sense. There's Dennis Haysbert's character, who, I feel so bad about that, because he's not given enough to do, and it feels like it's paying lip service to the difficulty of Khan's trying to re-enter the working world, and then he's basically... He's in the right place at the right time to facilitate the big heist in the film, and then he's shot to death unceremoniously. But all of these little moments end up actually meaning something after all, so it funnels back down to a single point by the film's end. And in that respect, like, that's a very weird way to go about making any kind of film, let alone one that people will look at as superficially as a cops and robbers film. And I think your idea of the novelistic approach actually makes a whole lot of sense for a film like this.
Yeah, I mean, it really is one of these things, or I mean, I will say this, like, again, amongst the films, I would say, I've said it before and I'll say it again. The major precursor to this film in terms of Mann's filmography, aside from L.A. Takedown, is Thief from 81, his first film. On a whole, I actually prefer Thief. But the thing about Thief is it's also a much tighter, much punchier film in its construction and the way it works. It's like a short story. It has a very laser focus on what it's talking about, what it wants to do. It builds those characters, has a very firm sense of three-act structure in terms of how it's executed, and it goes to some very dark places in a way that is not comforting and which will punch you in the stomach. This film, again, I mean, it's happening on such a grand scale that it never quite... the impact isn't the same thing. And I guess I feel like we're going over almost... I think it was Edgar Allan Poe whose idea that everything's sort of unified by, in a short story, to try and achieve one effect, as it were. And that really seems to be the distinction there. Man's going for such multiple things in Heat versus, you know, the very concerned or focused attempt what he's trying to achieve in Thief. Which,
okay,
by the way,
that
again,
might
folks,
be...
if you...
Go ahead, Dave.
No, it wasn't important.
Okay, well, because I think, obviously, like, with a film of this budget and this scope, and a filmmaker who is as sort of, like, technically celebrated as Michael Mann, we'd be remiss not to talk about the film style. But I think that's that's an interesting counterpoint because aesthetically, in terms of its composition, this is a very structured and ordered film, and not just in the sense of like the complexity of the action sequences, but the way that Los Angeles is framed as a series of roads, as a series of grids, as a series of building plans and escape routes and everything being mapped out. Like, I wonder if it's meant to be an ironic counterpoint of the fact that LA is presented as a city that is very clockwork, very tightly ordered, and yet the lives of the people working within it are completely chaotic and do not neatly categorize themselves. What do you think of that?
I think it's a very interesting and probably very apt reading of the film. I mean, certainly, again, you know, even just looking at, again, to come back to sort of the narrative content, so like there are so many little details and narrative points that, again, add to the texture, but aren't necessarily explored in depth. Like one of the things we mentioned Wangro and the fact that he disappears. One of the major details they bring about his character that is raised and is never pushed any further is the fact that the dude's a serial killer. In a very little sense here. Yeah.
That's a flashback when they talk about it, right? Like, that's non-linear.
Oh, no, it's not a flashback. No, that's happening at the same time. That's a contemporary. Yeah, because he kills. Yeah, that's when they leave the diner for the cops party that he and everybody, including Bosco and the rest of his crew, all go to check out the prostitute who's been murdered. And he has to hug the mother there, and then he heads back to the diner to pick up his wife.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think I was warming up pie at that scene. Because that just struck me as odd, because the way that I walked back into the room, it seemed like there was all of a sudden a flashback. I thought, for some reason, the scene felt like it was happening before he joined the heist crew, and that struck me as so weird, because the rest of the film is told entirely contemporaneously. Okay, that solves that question. So yes, back to Wangro as the serial killer.
But yeah, you have like a detail like that, I mean, which doesn't, I mean, ultimately the fact that Wangro is a serial killer doesn't matter to the narrative in the sense of it is plot significant, because it's not plot significant other than the fact that it offers another disruption to the life of William Hanna at that point in time.
Yeah. And it gives the film a clear villain.
In a certain way, I mean, Wangro is the one person you can point at and say he's absolutely morally reprehensible and despicable. Because, I mean, again, in sort of the terms of what's laid out in this film, he's not really a professional. So it's not like he's even skilled at what he does. He's just a loose cannon that's causing chaos for everybody because he is so utterly inept and, you know, without any sort of moral compass in any way, or moral or ethical compass in any way. But the thing about, you know, the thing is that, you know, one of the nice things is it adds texture to the world. There is a larger universe of LA and stories going on that are happening at the fringes of this movie that it feels like it can barely contain. And I think that plays very well off of man's very meticulous, methodical style and approach in construction of this film. It's the sense that, yes, this is a tightly wound narrative, but it's always at risk of falling apart. And again, to sort of come back to your point about the visual presentation of LA, it definitely feeds into that as an idea, that, you know, we're given a very rigidly presented and very cold and seemingly, again, for a film titled Heat, the use of the beautiful blues in this movie, that give it almost this weird coldness to it, is, you know, I think very deliberate and very unique. And I think
certainly in the domestic scenes, it's not coincidental, I don't think.
Yeah, no, and it never is in terms, like, a man is somebody, again, like, he's one of those filmmakers. I can guarantee you, every day he was shooting, there was not one single shot that appears in that film wasn't, again, you know, something that ran through his head 50, 60 times before he finally decided, no, this is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing it. He's not an intuitive filmmaker in, like, say, I'm trying to think of a good counterexample. Like, there are those filmmakers who can go out there and are just sort of, you know, we can freewheel it and sort of find it in the edit. I don't get the sense that that's ever the case with Mann.
I would argue with you there, because technically his films are very planned out, but even in Heat, it seems that a lot of some of the little details that we talk about and just the strange asides that characters have, like some of the dialogue scenes were improvised on set.
This is true.
How can both of those things be true without that meaning he cares far more about the presentation of his films than the content?
Well, I think this, again, sort of comes back maybe to what we see, again, in that sort of Chris Nolan comparison I made earlier. I think Mann, as meticulous as he is, and maybe this is a good way to look at it, he's meticulous, he's thoughtful, but he's not ignorant of the fact that, you know, stuff can happen in between and, you know, to find ways to work it in. I mean, certainly when I say he's not a, you know, improvisational filmmaker, I'm certainly not looking at him and say, this is a terrible comparison. Well, Richard Linklater and the sort of Before Sunrise, Before Sunset films that he's made, where it almost feels like there's something very loose and like they were really sort of improvising scenes on the days they were shooting at versus what we see here. You know, Mann has a very clear vision, but he is willing to work within it. Whereas very rare, I don't know whether I could ever sit there and say Christopher Nolan really allows for improvisation on his films. Like, his films are, again, and I'm not saying this as a negative against him, and I'm certainly not saying that his films are without emotion, but I think there is a level further detachment in construction to his work compared to Mann's. Whereas Mann, I don't think you ever lose the emotional content of his films, I guess is the best way to look.
I guess Nolan and Mann strike me as similar, where it's not that they're not directors that, like, there are some directors that are like the actor's director, you know, but I don't ever get the vibe from either of them. I think they would very much, I feel like they would find some way to construct a film where they can be seen as enabling a lot of improvisation, but I feel like just the kinds of filmmakers they are, it would have to occur within an incredibly controlled setup. And like Christopher Nolan, you know, well, I will give him a lot less credit than I give Michael Mann. We might have that conversation someday. But right now, It's like, I feel like Michael Mann as a filmmaker is almost trying to do too many different things. And I feel as a result, like, because there's never that core to the characters beyond, like, their function within a narrative, I feel like this is a film that's more about spaces, more about technology, than it ever is about people. And especially with everything being high gloss and, you know, huge budget and, you know, microscopic amounts of detail, like, I use the term in our discussion notes, the cinema of sterility, where everything is beautiful, but I feel like it's all superficial, because even, like, the emotional notes that the story is trying to hit, I feel like they just ring hollow. And, I mean, I think that speaks also to an issue I have with the film in that its points of identification are messy, if not altogether non-existent. But I feel like this is a film that it's this tour de force in terms of being able to look at it, but in terms of being able to invest or have a reason to care about the people living within this world, I feel like the film fails in that regard.
See, and I would disagree, because I think, and this is one of the things, I don't see the division with Mann. I think, you know, that attention to detail, that sort of sterility that you're referring to, is part and parcel of his characters as well. I think it's all part of a unified world that he's creating and a unified vision for it, but it doesn't feel like they are secondary in a way. I think everything's towards forwarding in that sense. And I think most of the, again, almost all of the emotional, you know, consequences and damage that this film wants to do, it hits the nail on the head. I mean, there are quibbles in scenes where I would say don't quite work. Certainly anything involving Hannah's, not everything involving Hannah's wife, but certain scenes, the writing is maybe a little too theatrical or mannered. And I think part and parcel, the actor who plays Justine, Diane Venora, her performance is, I get that the part of the point here is that she is somebody who is sort of self-medicating.
Zonked out on tranquilizers, right? And I mean, like, again, yeah, that's very deliberate why she's flat, but I don't know. It's like, and when I say cinema of sterility, like in Heat, I think that that has that doubled meaning where Macaulay is unattached to people. He is terrified of the idea of letting Edie into his life. And Hannah is, like, completely failing at domestic bliss. So in a film like this, it makes sense. I get it. But in watching it play out, I feel like you're always experiencing it at a remove. And so it's very difficult for me to, like, get invested and feel in things. And I think the other problem, just where identification comes in, it's like, okay, there's that tense moment where Edie discovers that, oh, Macaulay's actually a criminal and not a salesman. And he has that moment where he drives up to the bluffs and he's like, look, if you want to walk away from this, you can go. I'll let you. I won't hold it against you. This is also a man that she has just discovered has been lying to her, is a criminal who is linked to the deaths, the murders of a number of different people. And all of a sudden he's saying, well, no, you can do what you want and I'll let you pick. Do you honestly think that she's not going to feel any pressure whatsoever to do what he wants, David?
It, again, I would say in terms of the way the relationship is portrayed, and certainly in terms of his interactions with her, I could see a scenario where, yeah, she would believe him to that degree. And that's the thing. I think ultimately, fundamentally, I think where we differ here is the degree to which we're willing to go along with, you know, Mann's style of narration, I guess, is the way it worked. Because I think Mann is, he's detached, not in the sense that he wants you at a remove from the characters, but I don't think he's ever telling you what you have to feel or what you need to, what your expectation is. I mean, whatever morality you're going to bring to the film is one you're going to bring to it. Whatever care you're going to bring to it, who you're choosing to care about is who ultimately you're going to care about. He's not going to sit there and say, you know, you're not going to get the emotional cue where you have to feel sad at this exact moment.
I disagree with you there. I think the ending of the film, we are definitely encouraged to feel an emotion there. I think when Chris makes his exit, we're supposed to sort of see that as a happy ending. Like, the problem is, you got to realize that when a filmmaker is giving you violent criminals and slightly unhinged policemen and saying, well, there's no morality, it's up to you. You have to realize, David, that that is imposing morality by saying that these things are not clear cut, that maybe it's not good or bad. On one side, you have criminals and murderers, David. And I feel like the film dodges all of that because they're like, well, they're not as bad as Wayne Grow. He is a criminal, but he does it the wrong way.
I wouldn't say that the film, you know, I don't think that the film, I would disagree with there fundamentally. I don't think that the film is unaware of their crimes. In fact, I think one of the great strong points of this film is the fact that if you want to say that the film has charmed you with their behavior for the early part of the film, again, when you get to that shootout after the bank robbing, you know, there is no mistaking for the fact that these people are, you know, destructive individuals. I don't think that the film is sitting there absolving them of any way, shape, or form for the crimes that they have committed up to this point or anything past that. And certainly, I cannot in any way, shape, or form say that Chris's ending is happy. There's nothing happy about his ending. Yeah, he gets away, loses absolutely everything in the process.
Yeah, the wife that hates him and was going to divorce him anyway. She loved him so much, how come she's renting hotel rooms with Mo the bartender?
Again, I think that's sort of looking at this. Okay, I think that's a very binary way of looking at their relationship that I don't think holds up in the course of the film. I think that their relationship, it's messy, it's screwed up, and it's definitely not healthy for either one of them. But it is something that on some fundamental level, yeah, they do care about one another. As wrongheaded and as bad as a choice as it may be for him to get there. And in both instances, yeah, they're both going to be screwed up in some way, shape, or form. Because in the case of Chris, he can't get back there. He's not going to get to see his kid grow up. He's not going to get to be part of a world. Ultimately, this is a guy who's probably going to die in a ditch due to gambling debts once whoever he's in deep with gets a hold of him. I mean, certainly his entire crew and network of people are gone at this point. So I don't see how you can fundamentally look at the end of his story and say, yeah, he made out A-okay.
It out, unlike everybody else. And I mean, but that's the thing, because in your notes, David, you also point out that this is a film, like, dialogically and narratively, it's built on binary decisions. And there's, when the crew realizes that the LAPD is onto them, they have that moment before the big score where McCulley tells all of his boys, he's like, look, this might not end well for any of us. Right now, we have the choice to walk away. Are you in or are you out? And they all say that they're in. Like, this is a film that's structured upon binaries. Cops and criminals. It's men and women. The light and the dark. Emotion or duty. This film does impose a lot of binaries.
I would say you're... No. I think you're really stretching the binary of the choices they make versus the world they live in. Again, I think this is the distinction between the messy reality that they exist in versus the order that both they and that they're trying to impose on it, and man is imposing in the sense of trying to contain it in the sense of a narrative. And part of the point is that it doesn't add up. It doesn't ultimately, you can't bring it down to these binary choices. And when you try and break it down to these binary choices, it bites all of them hard in a way that
is true.
Them. And that's the thing about it. It's like part of the parcel is, they all decide, it's like, it's got to be one way or the other. It's always extremes for these people. Like, nobody has the ability in this film to function. And the reality is, that's a terrible way to go through life. And the film is fully aware of it, going from one end to the other. And ultimately, yeah, I mean, I think when we get to the end of the film, we have a conclusion, certainly. But I don't think we have much in the resolution of, other than McCulley's dead, he's about the only character who maybe breaks even in the sense that, well, he's not going to jail. But Hannah is going to repeat the same messy, screwed-up situation that's gotten him to this point in the first place. You know, again, Chris is likely going to just die in a ditch somewhere. And
what
else
about Hannah's end that makes you think that he is just going to keep repeating? What in the film suggests that?
That's exactly the point. I mean, again, we know his marriage is going to basically fall apart. He is a guy, again, as one of the things that we've seen repeatedly throughout the film is, this is a guy who's been married 3 times now, and each time it ends the same way. And he's cognitive of that fact, and he still does it anyway. And that's, I think, the thing about it is, yeah, this is a guy who, there's always going to be another Neil McCulley. There's always going to be another person he's going to chase. He's always going to come up with another rationalization for why he's out at 2 a.m. hanging out with Tone Lock and basically shaking him down for information.
We should all be so fortunate.
What's the name of that song? It's the same song. Funny, it was the thing. It's like the connection to Daredevil. That stupid
House of Pain
song playing in. Yes, thank you. The House of Pain song.
The one that wasn't Jump Around. Yeah. Irish Eyes.
And that's the thing. I think... Sorry, no, didn't mean to cut you off there.
Well, let me ask you this, Dave, because we also sort of went back and forth in our discussion, our pre-discussion, about the idea of heat as tragedy. And yes. I'm asking you this, though. The whole point of tragedy is that there needs to be pathos. And you can't have pathos without there being some kind of an emotional investment or without a clear sense of morality. Because if bad things just happen to people, that's not pathos. That's not identification. That's not emotional investment. So, all right, let me ask you 2 questions that are linked. One, do you see the film's conclusion as tragic? And if so, how can you see that as tragic without saying that this film is encouraging us to read McCulley in a certain way?
I would say it's tragic. Yeah, like I said, I mean, do I see it as tragic? I don't know. I'm going to, flat out, I'm not going to give a straightforward answer because I certainly think the ending of this film is inevitable. And I think that in itself does achieve of, if you want to call that tragic, that's fine. I would say, again, I don't think morality and tragedy are inherently linked. The idea that you can have sympathy and an understanding of a character does not inherently mean that you agree with the morality of that character. I think if there's a tragedy, it's in the sense that, Neil McCulley could have, fundamentally, at any point in time during this film, he's given numerous opportunities to walk away from this and go off and live somewhere else. You know, regardless of whether it's right or wrong for him to get away with anything, putting that aside, fundamentally, he could walk away at any given number of times, and he chooses not to.
Up until he takes the U-turn.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I one of those details I love, the way in which the light in the tunnel ends up echoing back as he's shot on the not the tarmac, but certainly on the airstrip field there.
Yeah, like, that's a really well-done scene. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to come off as excessively negative, because that's a scene that I think could have been a lot clunkier in anybody else's hands. But the way that man does it, by just having a sort of fade to white and a close-up of De Niro's face, no dialogue has to be uttered at all. It just conveys everything you need to know, that even though you know he's probably going to turn the car around, it happens anyway, and it still feels right, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, exactly. there are a lot of little moments, and I mean, you would hope there are in a 3-hour film, where it does succeed, and it sort of allows, it communicates a lot of things non-linguistically. But I'm just, by the time you take the film as a whole, I'm not totally sure what it's trying to say.
I think it's very clear what it's trying to say. I think really what we're coming down to ultimately is the question of, you know, director as the storyteller. Fundamentally, I think it comes down to, are you on the wavelength with man as a storyteller to go with the choices he's making, to go with the way he's thinking. And sometimes it's a yes or no thing. Like, it's not even a matter of whether he's good or bad necessarily. It's a matter of, are you with it? Like, and again, actually, this is a good counterpoint, is Steven Spielberg. There is a filmmaker I can look at, and I will say, I think Steven Spielberg is a tremendously gifted storyteller. I also, for the most part, am not fond of his method of storytelling. It rings as phony and false, and it's very much there's a plastic quality.
There's a calculated sentimentality.
Exactly. That rubs me the wrong way, and on top of that, I think it's also the fact that because of who he is, there is a prestige expectation or value that ends up getting attached to what he does that I don't think is inherently earned by what's ultimately done. And I know there are plenty of people who, you know, they'll watch E.T. and they'll cry their eyes out, and they, you know, will watch many of his supposedly big emotional films, and, you know, they'll fall for it. And many of those, they just leave me flat. Like, I can't get on board. I can't go with it. I mean, there are obviously exceptions to that. I think Jaws and Raiders are just about perfect films, but I don't think in either case, sentimentality and emotion in the sense of trying to draw, you know, sympathy or empathy out of you for these characters is really what either of those two films are going for in any way, shape, or form. And that's it. And again, it's not, again, because of a lack of skill on Spielberg's part. It's simply, that's his perspective on the world. That's the way he sees things. And it just strikes me as resoundingly false and phony in a way that I just, for the most part, I can't get on board with. On the other hand, Michael Mann, I mean, for me, again, that just strikes me. It feels authentic. It feels like something where it's, yeah, no, I can see this. I can buy into this world. And, you know, it makes sense to me in a way that I think very evidently, you know, you're finding problematic or that you're not able to sort of attach into. And again, unless I'm totally misrepresenting you, but I mean, certainly you seem to acknowledge the skill set that he has, certainly, and the storytelling chops, but something is functioning as that removed for you.
I think actually, when you brought up Spielberg, for some reason I started thinking of Munich, which is certainly not Spielberg's most celebrated film, and a lot of people are put off by that because that's also a film that really delves deep into questions of morality and can you do what your enemy does while still claiming to be righteous. And I guess that in a film like Munich, though, I feel like that succeeds more because a similar dilemma kind of plays out in Heat, where it's like, well, maybe people aren't necessarily, you know, unequivocally good or bad, unless you're Wayne Grow, that people are flawed and sometimes things don't make sense. But I feel the film doesn't do anything at the level of narrative where characters have that reflexivity. And because it's missing that reflexivity, like it doesn't make it a point to interrogate that as a theme, I feel like what you end up, as you're saying, a lot of how we read the film is what we bring to it as viewers. But I feel like without being overt about getting the audience to think that these things are arbitrary and morality can be relative, the problem is that a lot of people will walk away and just think, oh man, what a suave gentleman criminal that Macaulay was. He's a pretty cool guy. And if there's one pet peeve I have in movies, it's just toxic masculinity being celebrated as noble.
But the thing about it here, okay, there's two very separate things going on here, is that fundamentally, what a viewer ends up taking away from a film is not only a something that I like, I will always object to what I can come down to is to what a filmmaker seems to be suggesting. I cannot hold against a filmmaker what the and random audience member is going to take away from it. And I think that's a fundamental problem there, is because ultimately it doesn't matter, you know, you can make your film as thumpingly obvious about the morality or lack of morality or whatever issue you want to talk about, and somebody's going to walk away not getting it. And the reality is that isn't a fault on the part of the filmmaker. That is something on the part of the viewer and ultimately what we expect of a viewer to engage with. And the reality is, if you're going to have a filmmaker like Michael Mann, who is going to sit there and put a level of trust in the audience to sit there and be able to say, I'm not going to tell you, what's, you know, necessarily what you're going to think or per se about any of these characters or what you should be objecting to morally or ethically about things, you know, that has to come part and parcel with the recognition that there are going to be people who walk away from it. And what can you do ultimately, fundamentally, is about that, because I don't know how you can hold that against the filmmaker ultimately.
But okay, I think maybe I phrased that wrong. It's not that I'm necessarily saying that Michael Mann is being irresponsible, but I feel like you're talking about this film's treatment of morality as kind of arbitrary, as if like that is a critical part of the film's subtext. And I feel like it's not that it's a poor philosophical stand that he takes. I feel like this is a film that isn't concerned with morality at all. And I think when you're dealing with subjects such as people on opposite sides of the law or making hard and brutal choices out of necessity, to not take a position doesn't seem satisfying to me. I feel like you can't tell that kind of story and assume that Michael Mann sort of wants us to sort of leave it open to the viewer. I feel like that needs to be more clearly signaled at the level of theme for me to totally be convinced of that.
See, and like I said, I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I don't think that Mann is, I think Mann is simply, and again, it's much of the way in which his films are. I mean, ultimately, you know, he doesn't feel a need to hammer home that these are, you know, amoral people or that these are criminals. I mean, if you accept them as amoral criminals, that should be startlingly obvious right off the bat. The point of the matter is they are people that are part of our world. They exist. And ultimately, he's exploring them. I don't think he ends up, you know, raising Macaulay or any of them to, you know, this is not myth-making in the sense of, you know, we're going to walk away. Like, I think, and again, another counterpoint to this is, let's take a look at another Al Pacino film, Scarface. There is a film that I think in many ways, it invites its audience to relish and go with Tony Montana and view him as some sort of folk hero. And I think in many great ways, the culture that's sort of built up since then surrounding that film, and in particular, Tony Montana's sort of the world is your view of him, is, you know, I think very indicative of that. We haven't seen that with Heat. We haven't seen, there is no Macaulay was right. There is, you know, there isn't the Tyler Durden, like, oh yeah, you know, misreadings of the film where people are just going out and doing, viewing Macaulay as some sort of folk-esque hero. as it were. And I think part and parcel of that is because, you know, man is just straight objective, you know, objective in terms of his presentation of what he does. He doesn't, he doesn't feel a need to hammer down on it because, I think he does trust the audience to be able to recognize that this is a fundamentally, you know, flawed human being who is doing vicious acts, but we can't pretend that that isn't part of the world, or that you know, is somehow, again, to point to your own thing, this bifurcation, this idea that, you know, this is somehow, you know, completely separate from the various other points of, you know, his existence. The fact that he can, do an act of kindness. The fact that he is, in his own way, looking out for his crew, as it were. That's not to say that I don't think man expects you to view that those choices negate what he, you know, the evil of Macaulay. It's just they're sitting there side by side with who he is, with the crimes he commits.
I mean, I agree with you there, where, like, it's not necessarily wagging the finger, and I don't think that a film necessarily has to. I just feel like, okay, this came up at work yesterday, but just indulge me for a moment. Do you know the song Free Sure. Will by Rush?
Oh, yeah. I think everybody who's Canadian knows Free Will by Rush.
Well, yeah. And just the idea that when you decide not to choose, you still have made a choice. I guess yes. I feel like, okay, I feel like sometimes by just not addressing kind of the elephants in the room, you know, whether or not man intends to or whether the film's even supposed to be about, I feel like it toes close enough to the line where it's sort of, you might want to think about, like, what are the consequences of, like, treating a self-destructive cop and a self-destructive master criminal as, like, equally noble or honor-bound to the other in its own right? You don't have to bring in morality. You don't have to have everybody, like, read from the Bible and talk about, see, this proves that this guy was right. But I feel like not having that allows the two of them to be equivocated. And I find that problematic, not just in my own politics, but I think as a viewer, it's problematic because we're sort of left with, well, who do we root for? Because you can't really cheer for both of them. You can't really condemn either of them. You're just looking at a lot of people. And again, that's fine, but it's not like Pulp Fiction. This is a film that sets itself up binaristically as the two opposite sides. And I feel like if that's the case, if that's what man intended, I don't think that's something that can work in a satisfying way.
I don't think, and again, I think fundamentally this may be a misreading of what man's doing, because I don't think he's setting him up as a binary opposition of white hats, black hats, in the sense of, you know, good and bad, in the sense, there's bad, there's crimes and there's the law. And then he's simply presenting both sides of saying, yeah, these are two opposite sides of the thing. Yes, one's criminal. Both of them, though, there are lives outside of what they do professionally as well. And I think
so. All that to say is your response to the film is both sides do it, and that's an okay takeaway from it.
I don't think it's a matter of, you know, but again, I think that, you know, you're looking for a, you know, moral reading that somehow justifies, the actions of characters. I don't think man's looking to justify anything. I think he's just simply presenting. It's like, this is what it is. I mean, it's
but this is not cinema verite, Dave. This is not just turning on a camera and filming real life. This is a narrative. And I guess my question is, in the absence of, like, us having to either decide, like, hey, Macaulay actually was an honorable man after all, or no, one of these guys is clearly wrong. In the absence of that, let me ask you straight up, what is this movie actually about then? Of making the movie Heat?
Again, I think it simply is sort of an exploration of the self-destructive nature of these characters' lives. I mean, you can look at that as simplistic or facile if you want, but the reality is, I find that fascinating. I find the idea that this is a film simply about, yeah, here are the people who, you know, in a very different film, it would simply be good guy chases bad guy. Here's the larger world, and here's how they, you know, ultimately in some ways destroy screw up the lives of them, those around them, and not necessarily in the ways you think they're going to. necessary. It's not always a strict, you know, they screw up in the obvious way or that they have the obvious flaw. It's, again, that these are complicated people who, yeah, yes, one of them is clearly in the wrong, but that doesn't mean we can't look at them from the other thing. Because I honestly think this is one of these cases where if we always have to have somebody, you know, a point where, you know, a filmmaker sit there and is coming down and saying, fundamentally, by the way, this is right, this is wrong, I have to tell you these things and make my position clear, ultimately within the case of the film, clear, so that you don't come, you know, after, you know, so that we understand that right off the bat. You know, that's not treating the audience as adults, I think, fundamentally. That is asking it to do, you know, basically to, again, to be, in a way, rather simplistic. I think this is a film that invites, you know, discussions that go beyond that aspect there. And I'm
but
not
saying if that's it's not... a film, if it's a film about people's inherent inability to be categorized, why does it happen in this form, in the form of a 3-hour movie of a plot idea that Michael Mann has been working on for 15 years at a price of like whatever, $50 million or whatever this film costs to make? Why does it happen in this form if that's all Mann is trying to say with it? Because otherwise, it just becomes a technical showcase for what an amazingly talented, like, the scene composer he is. And don't get me wrong, David. I mean, this is a stunningly well-crafted movie. That climactic shootout sequence is incredible. Like, it, the tension is off the charts. Even just the audio miking and the mixing of it, it is like a bravura sequence. And there is a reason why, if for nothing else, people remember that. But I guess I'm trying to think of this film as more than just a showcase in that regard. But if I'm thinking about it in a narrative register, I'm hard-pressed to come up with ways that it's not. It's a film that wants to do some things, and maybe it's because the cast is so broad, or maybe because it's trying to do too many different things that make, like, it's hard to say what you should cut out or scenes to cut or characters to cut, but like maybe have they focused more on just a narrower set of people and given them time to breathe and grow in complexity, you know, that would be one thing. But then we'd be talking about a very different film. Instead, what we're left with is like 3 hours of messy real lives, but characters never really seem to change all that much. So what's the point in going through that if everything about their lives is metonymic for how they are when we meet them?
Again, it depends. If you don't find that fascinating, there's nothing I can say that's going to convince you, Andrew. I mean, ultimately, like, either you find that fascinating or you don't. And if you don't, that's fine. But I don't think that that all ultimately means that, you know, inherently man has made a film that is meaningless. I mean, whether you
I
like
never
the
said it was meaningless. I'm just saying,
but your ultimate
I feel like he's
was,
towing
what's
towards
point?
He's towing towards making points and hitting on a lot of things that seem to add up to something, but beyond just people gonna be people and I'm an amazing filmmaker, that's all I'm kind of left with at the end of it. And that doesn't mean this film is a failure. It just means that me as a viewer, I'm kind of left unsatisfied. I feel like you could say something more interesting or invite more of a critical reflection on the film. But I just feel like it doesn't happen. And I feel like without that happening, that's what sort of keeps this from being like a blowaway movie to me.
For me, like I said, the fact that it does go into almost a microscopic focus into the lives of this particular subsect, of this particular group of people, in this particular location, at this particular time, I think is ultimately what fascinates me. I am there to wallow into the murk with man and go with him. And I mean, again, and it's perfectly fine. I mean, I admit.
But what's fascinating about Macaulay? Like, we're never given a sense of what motivates him beyond the fact that he was in jail and he never wants to go back. And you talk about microscopic detail, and we get that with some characters. I don't feel like we ever get that with Macaulay, and we don't really get much of it with Hannah either. So, like, the periphery characters end up being so much more interesting than the leads.
And again, I would say that part and parcel, it's because of how they interact with the periphery characters that makes them so fascinating. Watching Hannah work his way through this while he sort of absentmindedly observes that stuff is going on around him and then failing to do things that he should be in his control. I do find that fascinating. I do find that engaging. I do find that this is something I want to follow through and see what is the end consequence. What does this actually mean to him as a person? And ultimately, does he ultimately change? No, he doesn't ultimately change. And again, I'm perfectly okay with that. I mean, I'm one of these people where I think, again, the idea of somebody who does not evolve or cannot evolve can be as fascinating as a person who does transform, because it then becomes a question, why don't they evolve? Why do they avoid these things? And I find that these are things that the film doesn't give you a clear-cut explanation, but it gives you hints, it gives you the details, and it does, again, I think it does leave it a good chunk of that to the viewer to bring into it. And I don't feel that, man, I don't feel it's skimming it on a surface level. I think Mann is presenting it there, and he is expecting you to engage with the text. He wants you to work with it to come to your end conclusions. And fundamentally, I mean, if you're with him on that, you're with him on that. If you're not, again, not a lot I can say to convince you otherwise.
And I mean, like, I think this is going to be one of those, like, you and I right now are Hannah and Macaulay in the sense that we're just wired to see things in a certain way, and that's the only way we can. And, like, I'm not trying to be obstinate or anything, and I'm not trying to say that.
No, I understand that, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's just to make it clear to the listener who hasn't ever heard me and David actually argue before. It's more, I feel like, I'm a very textual guy. I like when a filmmaker or a novelist, when they give you that little bit of trust where you can figure things out for yourself. I just feel like there's not enough in a thematic register. But again, that's why they make different colored jelly beans. We've also been arguing about this for quite some time. So why don't we turn down the heat, if I may?
But I'm done.
And why don't we steer it to our patent-pending recap of Hits and Pits? David.
Absolutely.
As our resident mansplainer, something maybe beyond the broad strokes we've identified, what is something, a little detail of this film that you really enjoyed?
Xander Berkeley.
There he is.
Like I said, this is the funny. The scene in question has actually been filmed three times, in three different contexts. It was actually done first for Michael Mann's Crime Story TV series with Dennis Farina in what is ostensibly the Vincent Hanna character. They're not the same character, but they have almost word for word. The entire scene happens there. It then happens in L.A. Takedown, and then happens in Heat. And in all three cases, it ultimately ends with the detective character kicking their TV onto the street when they're at the stoplight.
You can sleep with my wife, but don't watch my televisions. Hoo-ah!
Exactly. But I mean, Xander Berkeley, who, again, was in L.A. Takedown as the Wingro character, here pops up as Ralph, the poor schlub.
Poor Ralph.
As Justine says, degrades herself with in order to, quote-unquote, get closure with Hannah. And, Xander Berkeley is just a delight because he looks just so utterly uncomfortable playing off of Al Pacino at that scene. And
he's given to do are the only things that he needs to do. Look fearful and just meekly, "Hi, I'm Ralph. I didn't know you were here."
And it's a small beat in the film, but he plays it nice. So salute to you, Xander Berkeley. What about you, Andrew? What would be your first pick here?
Let's see. I'm just trying to think about smaller moments. I would be remiss if I didn't say I love the scenes in the detective squad room. I think the detectives themselves as a team, we got Drucker, played by Michael T. Williamson. I forget Wes Studi's character's name, and Bosco, played by Ted Levine, and that guy who was in The Master. I feel like there's just an organicism that they play off of each other really well with, and I ended up being like, this aspect of the film is a lot more interesting than just watching John Voight's growing liver spots and everything. I feel like... But those are the sequences that show, like, Michael Mann is no stranger to procedurals, but he knows how to make them well. And I get that, you know, not every single thing is going to be the same thing, but those are the scenes where you can see, like, yes, there is a reason why so much of procedurals in film and on television became influenced by Michael Mann's style, and those are the scenes where you can really see one of his strengths shining through as a stager of sequences. You know, nothing terribly impactful happens, but that's when he gives the characters a chance to interact and just breathe, and I feel those scenes, they work really well for me.
You're absolutely right. I love, I will never complain when somebody nails a scene where you just have a group of professionals sitting around discussing a problem and cooperating. Like, so much phony drama is built upon... Again, suppose professionals in fiction who are constantly at each other's throats are bickering. I like it when the, you know, this is a group of guys who are just, we're laser focused, we know what we need to do, and we're gonna do it.
Because otherwise, without those moments, you know, we're told Han is this top cop, but just watching him in the film, he's basically Bad Lieutenant meets Bad Lieutenant Port of Call New Orleans. So those are the scenes where, like, we are given that extra level of realism. Like, hey, no, this guy can actually run a squad. People respect him, and they know that he's unhinged, but he knows what he's doing. And that those are the scenes that make it real and organic for me.
Here's a question for you. Do you know who played Bosco in L.A. Takedown?
I do not. I think I encountered that, but I forget.
The one, the only, Michael Rooker. Like, so many, like, seriously, folks, L.A. Takedown, much more interesting than you would expect, really needs a release on disc. I really need to see it. But okay, yeah.
Another hit for you, Dave.
Yes, for me, it is Elliot Goldenthal's score, which, again, I love the sonic soundscapes of Michael Mann's films. Again, just as much as the visual design of his films is beautiful, and, you know, again, full credit here to Dante Spinetti as the cinematographer, who does a bang-up job with the look of this movie. But Elliot Goldenthal, who is a guy who I think gets overlooked a ton in terms of his the work he's done as a composer, again, he does some really good, interesting music here. That's not your typical, bombast, score. Like, it's not Hans Zimmer, okay, folks, who, you know,
thank
is going to
goodness
understand.
For that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a little bit more experimental in terms of what he's doing in this film. You know, it's built out of small cues and, you know, sort of rhythms here. And then you have the fact that, you know, even the song selection, you know, the two Moby tracks that are used throughout this, the Kronos Quartet, which opens the film. I mean, this is a great, great soundtrack. And Mann has had nothing but great soundtracks throughout his entire career. The only thing that could have made this better if it was Tangerine Dream, but you know what? That full credit to Elliot Goldenthal. I kind of wish people would pick up his work and take a closer look at it, because he is a highly underrated composer. This is also the same year that he did the score for another Val Kilmer film, Batman Forever, again, very different from what he's doing in Heat and very different from Danny Elfman's work, but again, really, really good. So do yourselves a favor, folks. Find the soundtrack and give it a listen. But what about you, Andrew? What's your final hit?
My final hit? Let's see. Like, again, without just singling out, like, one face out of me. Like, the ensemble cast, I think, works really well. So I'll just say, as a group, they're all good. I'd like to, like... As I keep saying, Mann, as a very technical and polished filmmaker, he can only do that with the assistance of other people, and I want to give a special shout-out to Dante Spinotti, who was the cinematographer on this film and a longtime collaborator with Michael Mann. I believe actually, yeah, most of his bare ones. He shot Manhunter as well, didn't he?
I think Last of the Mohicans. They also worked together. Was it on Public Enemies? Was the last one they did together?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got it up in front of me. It's also very strange because he also was the cinematographer on L.A. Confidential, which is one of my all-time favorites. But that's an interesting instance because he is making a very different kind of procedural. It looks wholly different, and not just because it takes place in the 1950s, but it shows like sort of how he can work with a different director to achieve very different results, even within the same genre. And I think it's kind of easy to take heat for granted now because so much of its look became co-opted into the mainstream. But to think about being in 1995 and seeing this on screen with, you know, just sunlit backgrounds and blue light and just, the composition of this film looks incredible. And I think Dante Spinotti definitely deserves some praise for that. And weird, weird fact, Dave, you know a film that he also was the cinematographer for released in 2002?
Of course, that godforsaken piece of garbage known as Red Dragon,
which Manhunter is the original film adaptation of. This is why we started this podcast, Dave.
Oh, man. You need to take a look also at, like I said, again, listen back to that first Cinema Chase episode, because it is, again, we get into that one a fair amount as well, because, man, oh God, do I hate Red Dragon with a passion. And what kills me is, you know, I said it there and I'll say it again. Brett Ratner, the scumbag, may he rot in jail if he's ever convicted for the crimes he's been accused of, spent the entire time bad-mouthing Manhunter and Michael Mann, Michael Mann's adaptation of Red Dragon as Manhunter in the lead-up to the release of his film, which, A, okay, fine, then you went out and hired a cinematographer, but B, watch Red Dragon immediately after watching Manhunter, and you will see shots for shot, you know, shots that, you know, Ratner swiped wholesale from Manhunter. Like, there is, again, my favorite is the helicopter landing. Other than the fact that it's a day in Red Dragon and at night in Manhunter, exact same shot.
If you're gonna steal from the best, right?
Well, you should absolutely.
Well, okay, and what about the pits for this film, Dave? I'm more curious to hear yours to see if you're actually capable of acknowledging any imperfections in Michael Mann's work.
Yeah, and like I said, I think the writing of Justine, combined with Diane Venora's performance. And again, I hesitate to blame Venora because she's doing what's asked of her, but the character, if there is a thinly written character in the film, it is Justine. And there's just dialogue that's too, again, for this film that is, you know, I think hyper-focused and hyper realistic in many regards and very focused on minutia. Her highly, you know, highfalutin dialogue about Hannah walking through, you know, life and, you know, her supposed, you know, sort of detached approach to her conversations about their relationship, it just strikes me as way too mannered and way too focused. And again, maybe this was meant to be like a light poke at like 1990s, you know, sort of hyper clinical approaches to relationships and therapy, as it were, or therapy.
Yeah, she speaks in diagnoses. I mean, that's all the dialogue she gets, but
yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's the kind of thing where it's like, she's not, I mean, again, she's not bad. She's not, you know, terrible or distracting from the film, but she is probably the weak link in terms of the writing and the cast. I will say that. And again, perfectly fine actress and other things I've seen her does solid work here. It's just, it's not up to snuff with the rest of the cast that you've got throughout this. But what about you, Andrew? I'm sure you have at least, you know, one pit for certain.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I would say this is more of a caution for the listener don't put this movie on if you're expecting, like, a big, exciting shoot-em-up the same way that, like, classic heist films generally are. Because, again, this is a film that presents itself as one thing, and to sort of, even in cultural discourse, we talk about it as if it's the thrill ride kind of film. And it really isn't. That's not to say that it's a bad investment of your time, but it is an investment. And so when you're putting it on at 8 o'clock at night after 8 hours of consecutive classes, know what you're getting into. But that kind of feels like cheating. So I will say my pit is that William Fichtner does not have enough to do in this movie. No, okay, for real, though. I like... Won't you say that, yes, Hannah is a very performative character, but we're also talking 90s Pacino, and he always carries that risk of just going so too far over the line where it ends up, like, distracting completely from what's actually happening diegetically, and you're just left turning to, if you're me, turning to your partner and saying, did that really just happen? And the moment that it pulls you out of the world, that's when it goes a little bit far. What about
I will certainly agree that this is Pacino walking right up to the line in this film. I mean, certainly it's not. I would say, you know, Scent of a Woman is where he really goes well past the line.
Yeah, and Devil's Advocate 2 years later, that's kind of where there's no turning back.
Although, at least in that case, that is so over the top. It's kind of like glorious in terms of just like, okay. Clearly, you can't rein him in anymore, so what else are you going to do with Pacino? But as far as another pit, like, I don't really have another, I would say, major one, necessarily. I really, really... dig this film. I mean, maybe the fact that
and
I
that's
can't,
totally you know, fine, you know.
Yeah, I would say, maybe the fact that I can't figure out who the Buck Henry looking individual who's playing Dennis Hesbert's boss.
It's Bud Cort.
It is Bud Cort.
It is Bud Cort. He's uncredited, but it is Bud Cort.
Okay,
AKA God in Dogma. Yeah,
I was kind of wondering because it's like I know this guy's familiar. Why can't? Obviously I didn't look close enough at the IMDb page because I scanned it like 13 times and somehow missed his name. But
yeah, I know that lack of chin anywhere. yeah, but this is a film where, yeah, it's everybody pops up at some point, which I guess, interestingly enough for forward planning, that makes me all types of curious, David. As we finally get on the freeway and outrun the driven policeman hot on our trail, where do you think this film's trip is going next?
Well, after looking at this and debating a couple locations, I am very curious to take us all the way to follow Artlands and Boulevard and go where the buffalo roam. The Ooh. 1980 comedy starring Bill Murray as... Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, a figure that I'm sure both of us will probably have plenty to say about when it comes to that, and his relationship with a fictionalized version of his longtime attorney. So, yeah, this will be a very, very interesting one to get a hold of, and a nice palate cleanser from Heat, if only because it's like a fraction of the length of it. Until then, Andrew, where can people find you?
Honestly, hanging around Fanshawe College in London. I currently am going through my exams this week, so one of these days I will get a new Twitter handle going, and I will get a website for our humble little podcast. Until then, you can still shout me out at YesWeCan, K-A-N-N, on Twitter, and that'll give me a reason to actually check it here and there. How about you, David?
I'm at 24Panels on Twitter. I think we'll probably take a little bit of a longer break between this episode and the next one, just so you can get past this exam season, Andrew.
I'm fine.
Yeah.
If 18-year-olds can handle it, surely I can too, I hope.
Yes. Yes. Well, like I said, you have the weight of many responsibilities on your shoulder there, Andrew. So
that explains why I have great power.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. Until next time, folks, I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser. And in the spirit of the good doctor himself, we'll leave you with when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. See you next time.
There we go. Bye, folks.